Welcome to Highway Diary. I'm your host, Eric Hollerbach. With me, for the second time, Chris Popbert. How you doing, buddy?
I'm very well, thank you.
And you're in New York City, you're being an artist. What's going on with you in your art life recently?
Well, actually, I've kind of taken a bit of a sabbatical with that, dealing with some non-serious but consuming health issues that are resolving just fine. And so in terms of my participation with the art world, I really haven't done much of recent about that. But the future is bright.
Well, you got a lot of connections. I had to do a little more self-care, too, you know. I had this pain in my back. I was, you know, I would always write jokes. I do stand-up comedy all the time. I was always writing jokes, and I was just like, why aren't I writing recently? Why aren't I writing? And I just realized I have this, like, dull pain in my back all the time. But, oh, my God, I got a massage, and I thought that they, like, cracked an aluminum can on my back, because now it's like I have so much more flexibility. I just feel amazing. So it's important to take the time to do some self-care, you know? But God,
it is.
It hurts so bad, though, but it felt, you know, the massage is a weird thing where the more they hurt you, the better you're going to be later, you know?
Yes.
I want to, you know, we're very political guys. We're very anti-war, peacenik kind of hippie people. And we both have been tracking what the warmongers want. And for a long time, they've been drumming up a war in Syria. And first person to start talking about this was a guy called Chucky Hagel. Now, this is him talking on September 4th of 2013. This is Chuck Hagel, the defense secretary under Obama, talking.
Primary objectives in Syria would be to hold the Assad regime accountable, degrade its ability to carry out these kinds of attacks, and deter the regime from further use of chemical weapons. The Department of Defense has developed military options to achieve these objectives, and we have positioned U.S. assets throughout the region to successfully execute the mission. We believe we can achieve them with a military action that would be limited in duration and scope. General Dempsey and I have assured the President that U.S. forces will be ready to act whenever the President gives the order. We're also working with our allies and our partners in this effort, key partners, including France, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and other friends in the region have assured us of their strong support for U.S. action. In defining our military objectives, we have made clear that we are not seeking to resolve the underlying conflict in Syria through direct military force. Instead, we are contemplating actions that are tailored to respond to the use of chemical weapons. A political solution created by the Syrian people is the only way to ultimately end the violence in Syria.
All right, so what's he talking about there, Chris? I'm a dum-dum. You know, there's a lot of political talk there. What is he saying?
Well, first of all, the way that I approach the world is we have to understand things from the primary method of consciousness on this planet, and that is money. And that form of consciousness is like blinders on a horse. It limits the framework in which we view the valuable thinking on this planet as being then monetized into this paper number, whatever, mythology. But that framework of consciousness is how the world is controlled. And that's what I mean by blinders. We cannot find a profitable way to end poverty, but we can find a profitable way to kill each other. which is to me insanely crazy.
No, we're just trying to protect the normal that we don't use chemical weapons. So this is we're not going to get into their politics. We're just saying, if you use chemical weapons on your own people, we will drone murder everybody until they are dead. Next question, General. So yes, what's wrong with that?
And the chemical weapons is, if you think about literary rhetorical devices, it's called a plot device. It is the storyline that justifies everything in terms of how we think about things going on in the mind. So WMD, chemical weapons, whatever it is, that's the plot device that hooks people into fear, and then they abandon all other avenues of conscious investigation. So we here, Syria, or whatever nation has WMD, and we then don't think about oil pipelines and banking cartels and whatever else the real motivation is. If I accuse you of having having a stockpile of pipe bombs in your cellar, I can go into your house and raid it, when what I'm really trying to do is stop you from talking to the press, for example.
Right. I know too much. So then the political guy, all he has to do is say, oh, well, that guy knows too much of what evil reptile creeps we are. So what's really going on is they use chemical weapons. Let's stage that video and then let's put that out. When I heard that when Hegel put out the video of the alleged chemical weapon attack on his own people, that was from another Arab conflict, civil war. Like, he used that video in this. It's anyway, let's hear John Kerry talked 10 days after Hegel. So I kind of want to see what
there is Kerry a clause has. In which we agree that we will contribute resources, including finance, to some degree. We have a certain amount of budget for this kind of purpose, and we will seek, in the process of the UN and in the effort to have a global commitment to this, help from many other of our international partners. But we're convinced the urgency of this will be a test for the international community's commitment to the Chemical Weapons Convention and to the importance of restraining chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction. So I think the global community will participate, and this can be achievable. As to where it is destructed, the experts really need to make determinations about individual weapons. Some can be destroyed on the site, many cannot, and that's something that will have to be part of the CWC process that will be contained in the extraordinary procedures that we've called for.
Now, the global community is now going to be reacting to these on an individual basis. Someone has chemical weapons. Someone has weapons of mass destruction. I want a global effort, so we all get up and we squash that. What is the real aim of this global community, and how could this be an abused force of power?
Well, again, I go back to money, and we don't see nomadic tribes of people financing industry anywhere in the world. We don't see that. So where did these people get this money? And if money is tracked all around the world. I mean, I can't even deposit $10,000 in paper money in my account without a certain form being filled out to track that, because that's to stop money laundering, supposedly. So you know, you have the country like India that's totally getting rid of cash because they want everything tracked. Well, you can't build the chemical weapons plants with cash that the nomadic people have suddenly, you know, I guess produced by selling camels and sand tents. we are totally ignoring the fact that there's probably 17,000 Swiss bank accounts that are all used to channel this money to these people. So where is that money coming from? And then the bigger question is, if we live in a country that, you know, just today I sent to a friend, it's published in Forbes magazine, you can Google it. If you Google 21 trillion, you will find out that Forbes magazine says that the U.S. government can't account for 21 trillion, not billion, trillion dollars worth of spending. So what is that money going to? A portion of that money, a tiny amount, but still to the average American, an ungodly sum of money, was sent to create a risk. And so when you look at Syria, it's very clear to me that some organization of people, it's not the government that you and I think of that operates things like the FFA or the for airline travel or the food stamp program or public health administration. It's the side of the government that creates a problem, and that problem has a cost, and that cost then is exponentially increased to fund some unknown program. I mean, $21 trillion is, I mean, that's bigger than the entire national debt.
Mm. So you're saying that
the last that I read, that was $16 trillion. So on top of the national debt, we then have $21 trillion. So you create a war that's costly, and then to mechanize and defend that war, you add all of these extra costs for some program we don't have really talked about openly in the corporate press.
So you think that there's a secret space program that they create these fake wars in Syria, and then, you know, they send Nazis to the moon.
Absolutely, I do believe that.
All right.
The extent of it, I don't entirely understand. But we have international consortiums like that operates CERN. And that's the Large Hadron Collider on the border of the French and the Swiss Alps. So that money is supposedly all accounted for. So I'm not talking about that sort of program, although I think that it has very real implications for the leading edge of science. And the leading edge of science is whatever the hell we are doing.
Mm. Now,
and if you think about Eisenhower's farewell speech of his presidency, where he talked about the military-industrial complex, one of the key points removed from that statement was he originally intended to call it the military-industrial-congressional complex. So we have a military that contracts with for-profit defense contractors to build whatever they are doing, And because they are out of the public realm and now in the private realm, they develop things that the government isn't even allowed to look at. Mm. And so that $21 trillion, in my opinion, my estimation, is funneled into these corporations that all have what's called interlocking boards, meaning a board member of Lockheed Martin might also be a board member of Raytheon, might also be a board member of Boeing, might also be a board member of whatever else
Goldman Sachs
you can think of.
Goldman Sachs, UBS, so they track where the money comes from. It goes into the deep state. Well, I don't know if I'm convinced about you, because I like a guy called Barack Obama, and 3 years after John Kerry made that speech that we just listened to, Barack Obama cleared up this whole situation. So let's see what he has to say.
And on Syria, let me just say this. We will continue to support the legitimate aspirations of the Syrian people, engaging with the opposition, providing them with the humanitarian aid, and working for a transition to a Syria that's free of the Assad regime. And today I want to make it absolutely clear to Assad and those under his command, the world is watching. The use of chemical weapons is and would be totally unacceptable. And if you make the tragic mistake of using these weapons, there will be consequences and you will be held accountable.
So it's just the Assad. That's what they keep saying. Assad's got chemical weapons. How'd they get them? Who's got the receipts?
So, yeah. So if you look at the issue from what companies and what country has the expertise to manufacture that kind of stuff, it's very similar to the equipment, the machinery, and the engineering know-how that the pharmaceutical industry uses. And what I have discovered is that a lot of German companies actually did business with, supposedly, the same kind of industrial infrastructure that creates these weapons, supposedly. But I go back to, this is a plot device. And I'm glad that you played the Obama piece, because in any covert military program, we have a way of hiding the all the puzzle pieces of how that program works through compartmentalization of information. And what that means is that each person in each little compartment believes that they are near the top of the compartment, or they believe that they are the solution to what's really going on. So I think that our presidents are in a compartment, and they're told with their security briefings, their intelligence briefings, a picture that has a stream of rationality. It makes sense, but in fact, it is not the real picture. It's simply a plot device for the president to conceptualize a problem when in fact there is something else going on. So when Obama talks about chemical weapons, I have no doubt in my mind he is being fed factual, probably, information about a chemical weapons program, but he is not aware of the other side of that compartmentalization, because he's in a little bubble. And really, the president mostly is a figurehead for the media. And you know, there's only so many hours of day. And most of what the president is doing is the public relations for the visible side of what the government does.
So you're saying that they tell him this story, he goes on TV, he says it, but what the level of secrecy that he doesn't have is that we made these weapons and we gave it to him so that we can find them on the Assad and then therefore bomb strike them and therefore get more money for Raytheon to give to make more drone murder.
Exactly.
So it's like, hey, you'll just know that the chemical weapons were found. We're not going to tell you that we put them there. We're not going to tell you that we've oversighted this whole process. And then you get to go on TV and make you look like the smart hero guy. And then we film you doing whatever the fuck we film you saying. And it's almost like that the chemical weapons attack is the name of the operation at large. It's like Operation White Snow is actually, we're shooting, you know, we're going across the border of Cambodia during the Vietnam War. You know, the Operation Chemical Weapons is just the recycled lie to hide whatever else is going on. But what's weird is that, you know, we talked last time you were on my podcast, is Trump draining the swamp? Are these 2,800 indictments going to start rolling out? Are people going to start going to jail over this? And then Trump gets on TV, and then he says something very interesting about Syria.
The purpose of our actions tonight is to establish a strong deterrent against the production, spread, and use of chemical weapons. Establishing this deterrent is a vital national security interest of the United States. The combined American, British, and French response to these atrocities will integrate all instruments of our national power, military, economic, and diplomatic. We are prepared to sustain this response until the Syrian regime stops its use of prohibited chemical agents. I also have a message tonight for the two governments most responsible for supporting, equipping, and financing the criminal Assad regime. To Iran and to Russia, I ask, what kind of a nation wants to be associated with the mass murder of innocent men, women, and children?
So, hey, why do you want to align yourselves, Putin, with Assad? We told you with bullet points that he's a bad guy. What's going on here? Yeah, I thought he was colluding with Russia, and now he's doing tough talk? I don't get it.
Well, exactly. In my opinion, the entire collusion with Russia is a red herring. It doesn't exist in the way that the media has portrayed it. And I know for fact, and it's publicly accessible documentation, that the United States government and the Soviet Union, as well as the Russian government, had joint nuclear submarine missions together. And they put both staff onto each other's equipment. So the fact that we're enemies with Russia is total bullshit on one level, because we work together. I mean, you look at the United States Space Station, we get to the International Space Station on Russian equipment. So we have a tremendous amount of cooperation. The fact that we have a PR campaign that we don't cooperate is, to me, really for the lower level of countries competing and how industry works. You know, right now we're telling Germany that if you put in that Russian natural gas pipeline, we're going to have economic sanctions with you, and that's so we can load this natural gas up on a tanker and float it across the ocean and then sell it to the Germans. So there's that level of competition. But when you go above that, we cooperate in space.
Yeah.
So obviously we're if Russia is an enemy, what the hell are we doing on their Soyuz spacecraft?
Right. You know what else is just like schizophrenic about this whole thing is I pulled up an article from August 8th of 2017 where Trump gave that press conference where, listen, Kim Jong-un, we will respond with fire, with fury. You will be fired. And then May 5th, 2018, under a year later, North Korea and South Korea sign a peace deal. So it's like fire and fury, and then was that to push him towards the peace deal? It's just like, why would you come with that rhetoric if then you want to get the Nobel Peace Prize? Was that all bluffing, or what was that?
Well, first of all, I have to say that it's really clear to me that one of the aspects of humanity is we like to try things. I mean, ultimately, life is an experiment. And we even talk openly on the corporate media about the Grand Americans experiment. No one knows if constitutional democracy will really work, so we call it an experiment in constitutional democracy. Well, so we had this war where we were fighting this evil communistic boogeyman, and it absolutely decimated Korea. And ultimately, war is never a winning strategy, because you look at all the wars that America has really fought, they've all ended in mostly stalemates or us losing. So Korea then cooled down its war into this demilitarized zone war where we split Korea in half. So the southern half of Korea went all capitalist. And in fact, if you look at South Korea, its GDP is bigger than Russia. Whoa. This little tiny speck on the end of a peninsula produces more capital goods than the entire 11 time zone of Russia. In fact, Norway and Russia and Korea are separated with Russia. Russia actually borders North Korea. So that's a huge nation. Then you look at North Korea, and it's an entirely different experiment. And in my opinion, North Korea was an experiment for a kind of, like, concentration camp of society to see how humans function. So you have South Korea, which is this contrast. Americans understand South Korea. I mean, we buy cars and cameras from South Korea. And North Korea produces what? Well, one of the things it produces is crystal methamphetamine, which feeds this black market, and that's how they finance their nuclear program. And whatever else that they did. Well, one of the industries that South Korea provides is the grand television of their worship of their dear leader. I mean, have you ever watched the Korean military parades? They are hilarious shows. It's like Busby Berkeley meets Dr. Strangelove.
He's riding around on the nukes going, yeah, and they're all like, oh my God, our dear leader. There's tears.
While women are in diamond-crusted outfits jumping into a pool all in uniformity. I mean, they've got the little cards and they show their pictures. I mean, it's grand theater. It is freaky amazing to watch and also terrifying.
It's like Scientology. It's like how they must feel about L. Ron Hubbard, who is the Pope, yeah. Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, with his magical science and...
So to me, North Korea, if it does unify with the South, and I believe that it will, it is simply an end to that particular experiment for social organization. And you look at Germany, Germany had East and West Germany, and the West had this huge... industrial surplus, and the East was in just communist rot.
Yeah,
Angela Merkel came from the Eastern side, and she's now running a successful unified Germany.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say Germany because that's the same thing, communism and this, like, but not just communism, as you put it, a concentration camp communism versus open market capitalism. Now, is there any example of communism working? And also, what my big question is, who is documenting these social experiments? Who's got the power to produce these experiments, and who is logging the information? Like,
all right, so who one example of, in my opinion, a successful communist model would actually be Cuba. And people probably might raise their eyes and go, what are you talking about, Cuba? Well, Cuba never had famine. And what Castro did was he revolutionized agriculture on Cuba to the point that you have to understand that communism has a different goal than market capitalism. So when I say that Cuba was an example of successful communism, yes, it relied on huge foreign aid, which made it very difficult for Cuba when the Soviet Union evaporated, but then Cuba allied with Venezuela, is my best of understanding. And so Cubans, they still drove their 1957 Chevys into the 80s and 90s and beyond, but their people were amazing at effective, organic agricultural programs that we in America don't even have a grasp on, because we have Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill.
So
who's documenting this sort of data? I believe, to the best of my knowledge, that the world functions through secret societies. And JFK talks about secret societies. All you have to do is Google JFK and secret society speech. And he gives this speech to newspaper reporters. Well, one of the secret societies that exists in the world is affiliated with the largest intelligence organization in the world, and that is the Roman Catholic Church through the Vatican. That's why they had confessions. That was an actual intelligence mechanism. So the priesthood knew what was going on in the town through the confidentiality of talking to the priest, which was really an intelligence officer.
Mm.
So the army of the Vatican is the Jesuits. And the Jesuit order is throughout all the countries. We have Jesuit universities. We have, so the Jesuits have a specific agenda. And to call it Christian isn't really true because, like, for example, the Koch's, I can't think of, I think it's Ford University, but I could be wrong on that. Jesuit economics is really laissez-faire, which is the market will bear, stay out of the way. The people who are recording this data and trying to achieve a certain goal, the best that I have an understanding of, this is operated through that Jesuit mechanism.
So I also read something that you put on Facebook one time that you're a part of some order that like you think that there's going to be a synchronicity happening soon or a disclosure happening soon of ET. Can you tell me about that?
Well,
where does that fit in?
I think that whenever a certain experiment reaches a maturity, there has to be a reset for additional growth to happen. So what you saw in Europe after the French Revolution and was that America was a reset of the monarchical order, and we got constitutional democracy, or what we are told is constitutional democracy. Well, America is now, what, 230 years old? So we're now reaching a level of sophistication where this particular model is no longer working. We have a military-industrial complex that has technology that hides its patents within the realm of top secret. Mm-hmm. And we don't need oil, and we fundamentally don't need money anymore. And if you think about the science fiction realm of plot device, you have the Star Trek world where, you know, Jean-Luc Picard orders his tea from what looks like a microwave oven and it just appears before his eyes. We now have this thing called internet that spreads information like crazy. So we have reached the natural reset point for a new paradigm. And that's what I think. That's what I think is coming, eventually. But there is an aspect of society that's resistant to that, and you take for example the oil industry. Those people who worked in the oil industry did so originally for honorable intentions, because the world needs energy. Their goal, in my opinion, you know, like you think about the petroleum geologists, their goal was never to destroy the planet. I grew up as a child having a friend of the family who was a petroleum geologist, and this guy was salt of the earth, just genuine, really wonderful, brilliant man. And so you have this infrastructure that doesn't want to lose its golden ticket to wealth and success. And then you have this other pressure that, you know, we've grown out of oil. We've grown out of oil long before we entered the 20th century. But we have stretched this rubber band that keeps certain nations or kingdoms like Saudi Arabia going. Russia has a huge oil industry, and now the United States produces more petroleum than even Saudi Arabia. So we're trying to force Germany to buy it across an ocean.
Yeah, or we'll give sanctions. And you're saying, like, so East Germany was an experiment versus West Germany. North Korea is an experiment with South Korea. Now that Germany's unified, now that Korea seems to be on the unification, maybe what you're saying is we got to reset because now we live in a different paradigm. America is in debt to China for buying its own oil or buying its own industrial complex or buying its own bullshit for too long. And there's got to be a new reset. So what do you think that would look like? And I think a bad sign of it is that, like Trump said, he's going to come in and drain the swamp. And then he's reading the bullet points from Chuck Hagel from fucking 5 years ago. You know, and he's just going, Syrian gas, Syron, Syron gas, Syron, Assad. Like, obviously the CIA created Assad. Obviously they made Al-Qaeda, and then they replaced it with the Taliban, and then they replaced it with whatever. And so that's a sign that things are not progressing the way we want, though. You know, so...
I think that that's a sign of one faction of interest that wants to keep us in rerun land, like television has TV land where it's all just this rerun. You know, my grandfather watches Gunsmoke still. So for him, the world has not changed because for the last 40 years, he's still been in Dodge City. And meanwhile, I don't even use television. I cannot stand television. Yeah. I gave it up because it simply was no longer even interesting to me.
It's like a residual ghost. You know, they one thing of haunt paranormal investigators, they always say, oh, this is a residual ghost. That means he's in a landmine, and the landmine crushes him, and now he's just lost in the mine for all of eternity, going, where's my canary? I've lost my canary. And so your grandpa's just living in this fantasy land of watching Gunsmoke over and over, and the American economy is in this oil paradigm of just going, no, we need more oil, more profits.
Yes. And then you have the machinery of Wall Street. I live here in New York, and let me tell you, Wall Street is... When you walk into Lower Manhattan, there is a vibration, or it is literally a vibration. It's amazing when you experience it. And those people have a very narrow view of what the world is. They are intelligent, really amazing people. But they see the world through this construct of consciousness, and they all have their specialities. And so you have, and they fund the United States presidency. I mean, Barack Obama had more bankers contributing to his campaign than traditionally Democrats get. So most of what Barack Obama or Trump is doing is actually servicing the people that funded his position interview. I mean, really, elections are these crazy corporate-funded interview sessions that go on for fucking ever on the media. So in one sense, Trump is, and any president, is just servicing that nonsense that isn't really the whole world.
Yeah. These guys, they all have their speciality, right? One is like, well, I know how to set up these algorithm robots that steal money from the system. And then another guy's like, well, we can set up all these modems and harvest cryptocurrencies, and all I need is a modem in Thailand connected to a modem in Switzerland, and that's my speciality of how to drain money out of the system. And then someone else is like, I know how to bankrupt schools. We're going to take elementary schools. We're going to buy them for pennies. We're going to sell them. All the kids are going to not have books anymore. And we're going to have fucking money. That's my goddamn specialty. And there are all these lizards that just are creeping around with their degrees and their ways of flushing money out of people that are actually like tilling the soil and making furniture, you know?
Yes.
And they're the biggest buildings downtown.
I have a friend who I have known for many, many years. We were very close in college. And he works in high-end genetics. The discipline is bioinformatics, which is how you analyze, catalog genetic information. And he's working on cancer research and pathology. He has a view of how medicine works that I think is so naive, it's not even funny. But he truly knows his field, and sometimes we're paid to not see the big picture.
Yeah. He could be just like in a cave going, well, all the other oncologists say this, where's my canary? Anyway, all the other oncologists say this, where's my canary? Just, you know, it's that there's something that happens in Scientology, I think, where when you're a Scientology and you're like a doctor of Scientology, you've read every single book of L. Ron Hubbard, like it's like literally a PhD level of coursework that you've gone through, but it's in utter nonsense. And the educational institutions can collude very easily with the pharmaceutical industrial complex, which pays them lots of money to keep these people in their framework where they're geniuses, but
no corporation is going to fund research that is going to kill their $1 billion pill to cure your restless legs with itchy head syndrome. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So we have this concept of science, and I believe in science. Don't hear me criticizing a particular method of discovery. What I'm criticizing is the goofy nature in which we validate science, because all of the peer-reviewed journals are owned by the same six media corporations, essentially. And so you're not going to get a peer-reviewed article that challenges established economic order, even though that it's scientifically superior to the particular economic order.
Yeah. And who owns the patent office?
Well, who owns the patents? That's a really interesting thing. Sometimes the patents are owned by the particular researcher or the institution.
No, I mean the office. The office that issues the patents.
Well, who issues the patents? I can't think of the name of the... It's a privatized venture now. That's a really good point. The patent office is now... that's when we take the concept of open source and we, in my opinion, in the way the world works, we rightly so allow the owner of whatever intellectual property that is to see financial benefit. I get that. That's why we have copyright protection on movies and CDs. I get that. But on another level, we have this bastardization where you have a company like Monsanto that is patenting these seeds that farmers plant, and a farmer that's not using that particular patent will try to reuse his seeds, but the pollen from the patented seeds will blow into the non-patented plant and insert the patented gene into that new crop. And so Monsanto is suing organic farmers for planting seeds with their patented gene that actually infected these other seeds through wind.
Yeah.
It's insane. How is that a theft of intellectual property?
Well,
because that's like saying your beehive can't touch my patented flowers. It's just insanity.
Well, that's my specialty. So I work on Wall Street, and then you can bankrupt a farm when the wind blows, and then you still did your You sell their farm, you drain their assets, and you keep going. What's wrong with this? Hey, let's meet at Hooters at 2. Okay, guys. Hooters at 2, corporate account. Okay, guys. It's fucked up.
It is really, really crazy. I like to read patents. Not that I have understood a single patent in its intended form, but it certainly is enlightening with how people conceptualize information. And the reason why I started looking at patents was because that's what Albert Einstein did before he became famous. And I read several of his biographies and went, wow, there must be something to those. Because as a child, I saw patented numbers on Happy Meal toys. So how does a Happy Meal toy go to, you know, revolutionary physics? Anyway, there are some patents out there with just amazing ideas that you will never see in corporate media. But you realize, oh my gosh, people actually think about turning a computer monitor into a mind control device by interfacing with the brain through radio waves, not through light. So it just like you go, what?
Yeah.
So people sometimes will accuse you of being a conspiracy theorist. And you're like, no, there's a patent for whatever weirdness that I'm talking about.
Well, even the facility at HARP, the Alaska High Altitude Auroral Research Project in Alaska, where in the patents that this is for weather modification, it's for mind control, it's for all these things. And you're like, wait a minute. So they even put in their patents that they want to profit from the intellectual property of mind control, so that they're so crazy that they put their evil plan into the thing to profit from their evil plan, so that we read it later and go, wait a minute. But that's why, and Fulford says that there's 60,000 patents that are under national security protection because they're too dangerous. And the other thing in the patent office is that you're not allowed to patent a perpetual motion device because that breaks the laws of physics. So they're saying that no new science can ever happen in the field of perpetual motion because we got oil companies. I mean, it's impossible. It can never happen. We've already done we're sick of doing these perpetual motion devices. They never work out. Don't even come to our office with that nonsense. But really, if you look at the secret societies, that's where they probably use these things.
It's like saying, we will not patent any flying machine that isn't a balloon.
Right. It's impossible. We've already got them.
It's now going all over the world. It's also the patents that are run by a sub-discipline of law that then also is its own compartment of worldview. So these lawyers have a certain view of thermodynamics, and you will not convince them that the expansion of the universe might be the answer to that side of the thermodynamic equation.
Yeah.
Because they didn't learn about it in wherever college physics they took or have knowledge of.
It's weird. There's whole industry of lawyers that only deal with asbestos when everyone was putting asbestos in their house. Now, even still, there's like a massive industry. Billions of dollars a year goes to asbestos law. And talk about residual ghosts, you know? They're just only in their little framework.
There was a time in the earlier part, around 2008, maybe into 2000, that the most expensive ad word you could buy on Google was mesothelioma. That was the most expensive. If you wanted to buy a Google ad word, mesothelioma was going to cost you more than anything else.
Yeah.
mesothelioma costs you more than McDonald's.
And that's a disease that comes from asbestos that you can call a lawyer and make an expensive claim about. So all those lawyers that want to advertise their firm have to pay $10 per mesothelioma.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because there might be a real expensive customer on the other side of that Google search.
Yes.
And we can take his suffering and make profit. Now, that's my specialty. I'm on Wall Street. I take suffering and I make money. So the Google AdWords are really, that's my problem. Yikes. You put an interesting thing on your Facebook feed that says, the U.S. put $50 billion towards Israel, but Flint doesn't still have clean water. I just thought that was just such a brilliant thing. It's like, wait, we have $50 billion to give to Israel, but a town has lead coming out of its pipes, and we got no, they're fucked.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
That, to me, is just... It speaks to a hostility that we have in this country that is quite frankly just genocidal. I mean, Trump talks about these unhuman immigrant murdering, raping people from Mexico, and we're willing to spend $20 billion to put up a fucking wall. Meanwhile, lead poisoning actually makes people violent.
Yeah.
So if we want to mitigate violence in our future, spend the $2 million and fix their water or whatever tiny sum it is compared to something else.
They can't, you could get a reverse osmosis filter on Amazon, but they can't make an industrial size one for Flint for under $50 billion?
It's because then you would have to put that through they have to dig up all the pipes. There's a certain protocol that water treatment industry uses to keep their pipes non-toxic, pathogenic,
right.
I would say.
Okay.
So all those pipes have been corroded and are now useless. Really, it would be cheaper just to tell the people of Flint, we're closing down the town, here's your voucher, go move somewhere else.
Wow.
And turn it into a ghost town. That would be cheaper. People don't want to move, you don't want to upset communities, but people are showering in this, and lead goes through your skin.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Patrick Claussen. He is a lobbyist for Israel that we give $50 billion every year. And Patrick Claussen said the creepiest thing ever on national television. And I just want to play. This is my final clip I have. This is my favorite clip if you want to know what Israel's all about.
All right.
I frankly think that crisis initiation is really tough. And it's very hard for me to see how the United States president can get us to war with Iran. Which leads me to conclude that if, in fact, compromise is not coming, that the traditional way of America gets to war is what would be best for U.S. interests. Some people might think that Mr. Roosevelt wanted to get us into World War II, as David mentioned. You may recall we had to wait for Pearl Harbor. Some people might think Mr. Wilson wanted to get us into World War I. You may recall he had to wait for the Lusitania episode. Some people might think that Mr. Johnson wanted to send troops to Vietnam. You may recall he had to wait for the Gulf of Tonkin episode. We didn't go to war with Spain until the USS, until the Maine exploded. And may I point out that Mr. Lincoln did not feel he could call out the Federal Army until Fort Sumter was attacked, which is why he ordered the commander at Fort Sumter to do exactly that thing which the South Carolinians had said would cause an attack. So if, in fact, the Iranians aren't going to compromise, it would be best if somebody else started the war. One can combine other means of pressure with sanctions. I mentioned that explosion on August 17th. We could step up the pressure. I mean, look, people, Iranian submarines periodically go down. Someday one of them might not come up. Who would know why? We can do a variety of things if we wish to increase the pressure. I'm not advocating that, but I'm just suggesting that this is not a either-or proposition. It's just sanctions has to succeed or other things. We are in the game of using covert means against the Iranians.
Whoa, they had to wait for...
Amazing quote.
He had to wait for the Lusitania. He had to wait for the Gulf of Tonkin. Look, people, war is great for U.S. interests. So what we have to do is create... The first thing he says is this.
Crisis initiation is really tough.
Crisis initiation is tough. This might... Look, my job of creating wars... God, I got to tell you, it's harder every year. You know, the people are waking up.
That is an amazing quote. So there is ample historical evidence that Roosevelt kept those ships in port and in Pearl Harbor. So, and we knew the Japanese were coming because it served a purpose for rallying the American people to get off their anti-war whatever. And that's exactly what 9/11 was. You have General MacArthur, I think that's right, or McNamara, General McNamara, who on his deathbed said that the Gulf of Tonkin never happened.
Well, he said it in a documentary, too, called The Fog of War, that the Gulf of Tonkin... He's like, oh, yeah, there was a miscommunication with a boat, so yes, we had to start Vietnam. Huh?
Yeah, so McNamara, if the forces that are capable of starting a war want to start a war, they will start a war. And the thing that allows... the war to happen is that people don't realize that it's always not started in the mechanism in which they think that it started.
That's the storyline. This guy's
that's
just
right.
This guy, Patrick Lawson, he's in the jungle. He's pitching storylines to
yeah,
start
it's,
wars.
Again, it's a plot device. It's a plot device, just like these. Stupid chemical weapons. You know what to me is amazing is I look at what was going on in North Dakota with the pipeline, and here we are tear gassing Native Americans in the same year we're bitching about Syria. So what the hell?
Yeah, chemical weapons what are the- just... We cannot allow chemical weapons. There will be consequences. Hey, natives, shut the fuck up. Just spraying them with tear gas.
No, you're right.
But it's like the chemical of the tear gas they used was probably looked over by a mesothelioma lawyer between gigs and was like, yeah, this chemical's okay, but not the other chemical. Those chemicals are evil. These chemicals are just... inhumane enough so they're legal, you know.
Well, so we have Israel that has invented drones, the little miniature helicopters that fly up and drop chemical a tear gas onto the Palestinians, but then we're complaining about Syria using chemical weapons?
Yeah.
It's just... and I understand that there's a difference of lethality, and tear gas doesn't have the same lethality as something else. But it also just, to me, seems really an arbitrary line when we're talking about something that hurts people and makes people suffer, when their real intention is that they're trying to protect their water or they're trying to protect their land. The people that are having tear gas dropped on them are not rich. They're simply wanting to keep their little tiny piece of whatever part of the planet they have intact. And well, then the huge force of government will drop some irritant on them and shut that up. That to me is what the danger of chemical weapons is.
So what's going on? How is this so evil? Are there lizards working in underground bases, draconian lizards that whisper secrets to Project Paperclip Nazi scientists that then whisper policy to deep staters that then whisper policy to politicians under their command that then whisper, then have the wrong idea about the knowledge they have? What is the chain of command of this, and how does it, will we ever see an end to this?
Well, ultimately, I think that I have no idea. I think that one can look at the lizards through a metaphor or through literal meaning, and both seem to me out of the grasp of my level of expertise. But using that as a metaphor, there is some parasitic malevolent force within the human culture, whether it's aliens, whether it's some kind of subterranean reptile, I have no idea.
But or like a dark...
I know for a fact that this world makes better sense when you know there is some kind of parasitic action in the world.
Yeah.
And whether it's Wall Street bankers or creatures living under the Vatican, who knows? But there is something really fucked up going on.
or a sociopathic nature that is induced through rituals of the Scottish Rite, perhaps. Maybe,
yes, exactly.
Maybe the rituals that Masons do and OTO members do are so evil that it programs their consciousness with a certain residual psychopathology that, you know, when there are very important people that are doing this, like Hillary Clinton and John Podesta, and they have a lot of power, boy, can they really leverage their evil.
You know, you speak to something that, like a computer, the human brain is like the hardware, and then you install the cultural software, and there are some people that are convinced food stamps is evil, where I think food stamps is a necessary good. So we have this software that is very arbitrary in how we function. I mean, you've got some religions that are convinced that that getting rich and being successful, I mean, that's like a certain Houston mega church has a view of Christianity that my parents were Lutheran pastors seems really crazy to me. They were Christian also. So you have these versions of Christianity that have diametrically opposed worldviews. And, you know, to call Orstein in Houston a Christian to me is like, that's a really weird Christian to me.
Yeah. When...
So we do have these constructs that mean that none of us are really capable of knowing absolute truth. We know our model of truth. So the psychopath who doesn't care if it hurts my feelings or my well-being or even my body, because it's good for them.
Yeah. One of the things my friend James Robert Wright has told me, and he's been on the podcast several times, and he was a 32nd degree Mason, well, still holds that, and a Knight of the Templar, is when he would relate to me the different initiations, I was just thinking, oh, this is all satanic ritual abuse. Like, he's just been abused so much that... he's witnessed murders in the house he grew up in, and the cops showed up and were like, hey, everything's fine here, and left again. And just like his whole worldview was like, well, there is an elite class that are untouchable when they are in a certain religion and they do whatever they want. And then there's the surface monkeys that are dealt with by the higher level. And just like the, you know, he doesn't always see it that way, but whenever I'm talking to him, I'm just like, man, you were so abused. And when a child is abused sexually, then he becomes a pedophile. It's like the system of Freemasonry just seems to be inducing a trauma to be perpetrated on against the masses then. I don't know. That's you were speaking of the secret societies and the Jesuits, and it's like, if that's who's running everything, that might be a mechanism of their methods.
Yes, and I also have to put out I always have a clause in my head that I utilize so I don't become an agent of unwarranted prejudice. And what I mean by that is when I learn something that pulls my triggers of reactionary, looking for a blame for the cause, that I recognize until further information. So when we call Freemasons the evil, malevolent force, sure, that could be possible, but it could also be there is another evil, malevolent force that's making the Freemasons guilty of something that they aren't. So I want to always recognize that people are innocent until proven guilty. And when we look for a blame, it might be the real evildoer's intention for us to put blame where it shouldn't be, when then we aren't looking at something else. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but the way I see it, it seems like that's the level of Freemasonry is like a filter, like a sociopath filter. You might say, oh, well, yeah, you'll be a master mason your whole life, and you'll pay the dues, and you'll be capped at that level. And then
Absolutely. You
will be a Freemason that doesn't really have any association with or knowledge of any of, like, talk about compartmentalization. That's
yes,
how I think
exactly.
It. Like, just to say the word Freemason, I think that's way off. But to say 33rd degree Freemason, I think that's pretty on point, where you don't earn that degree unless you do something really fucked up, like shoot JFK in the head, you know?
And yet, I have heard... A lawyer talk about a 96 degree Mason, or 96. So the fact that we have 33 degrees
right.
as supposedly the limit, who knows if the scale doesn't go higher? So I don't know if there is such a thing. I'm not a Freemason. All I can say is through whatever's trickled down into the information interwebs, to me it's entirely possible that there could be a 1,000-degree Mason. And anyone under that has no clue that there's a 1,000-degree.
And his penis talks to him and has horns, and it's into really weird stuff. But I wonder, there's like, what is the consciousness? Talking about consciousness, evil consciousness, clearly we can track with this Syria thing, this lie of this narrative that's put in the mouth of Obama, it's put in the mouth of Trump, of Chucky Hagel, of John Kerry. Who wrote that script? There's got to be someone to blame. There's got to be like, no, this fucking guy. Like Patrick Clawson, who's following the storyline, which is of his favorite topic of how did the war get made? How do we initiate crisis? That's my goal, initiating crisis. And so what is the consciousness that wrote that? Is it this deep state with all these nameless faces, people inside that have top secret clearance above the president's knowledge, and they're really running the show, like these interlocking board members? Like, we can never fix a problem if we don't point to a perpetrator.
That's because what the president really is a public relations figurehead. And any good public relations theorist would tell you that you need to communicate within a predictable framework. So if you're talking about your company making widget A, you don't suddenly want to start talking about magic fairy dust as your technology, because it's just too far of a distance between what the public is used to hearing about. And so we have presidents that are really scripted in the language that the news media has grown us accustomed to hearing. And so we have press secretaries and presidents that are responsible for maintaining the order of consistency.
Mm. So are we ever going to have a global financial reset, a jubilee where debt is erased and the currency starts to be issued by the Treasury Department rather than the Federal Reserve? Do you have any inside knowledge on that?
I certainly think I don't know. A part of it is some of that stuff I'm completely convinced is a psyop, meaning it's trying to prime people to that as a potential. I see benefits behind it. It could also be that ships from outer space beam down nano replicators into your driveway and fuck money. I mean, who knows what really is possible in this universe? I don't know. All I'm saying is the current situation has serious problems, and I want to make sure that whatever solution we have doesn't create an even worse problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it's meet the new boss, same as the old boss. So we have to be careful. All of this speculation of something coming, to me, I again put this as, well, that's in the realm of possibility. I'll advocate for the idea because something has to give, but I'm not sold that that's the only solution. Because, quite honestly, I want a nano replicator put it into everyone's freaking zone and instantly.
Yeah. That thing in Star Trek is pretty cool. You just say, yeah. I want some hot tea. You get some. That's pretty cool.
Yes, exactly.
And then, like, all other inventions are obsolete once you have an invention creator or a, you know.
That's right.
That's a, that would really disrupt a lot of the aspects of the economy.
Yes, it would. And, but you know what? When we think about war, Iraq had an economy before we totally destroyed it. So radical change comes if radical change comes.
Yeah.
You look at the people that lived on the coast of Japan. That was when the ocean washes your community away. Well, that was. So to me, I just want the radical change to be nonviolent and positive.
And it seems to me like, you know, horseshoes, that industry was really disrupted by the car, and the carbon paper strip industry was really disrupted by the personal computer. But that is the economy, and I think these guys did so well at capitalism. Like, you know, Blockbuster got messed over when it went from VHS to DVD to Blu-ray to streaming in 8 years. Their whole business model was renting these videotapes, and all of a sudden streaming was such a disrupt, but they went bankrupt, and the oil companies do not want to do anything except sell oil. So they will kill, yeah. they will discredit, they will bankrupt anybody. And so we're just stagnated. It's like instead of time ticking, there's this like catapult that has been being pulled back because the oil industry does not want that it to hit 12 o'clock and their business is over. But that lie has built into such an like such a dark cabal of secrecy of, you know, top secret, ultra top secret, kill your family top secret, kill all your grandchildren top secret, to protect oil and these inbred families that are all sociopaths, and they're running things.
Every day you drink the most efficient fuel ever created, and that's water. You take water, you put electricity through it, and it breaks it up, and you get hydrogen and oxygen. And with the hydrogen, you then combine it with oxygen, and you have a fuel 3 times more energy dense than oil. Why we aren't using water, I'll never know.
Well, there's this thing that was the Equant sports limousine that was in the Geneva Auto Show 2014, 15, 16, 17. It's street legal in Germany. It's owned by Bosch. Bosch bought the patents of this Equant sports limousine, but still it's not been mass produced. It's like, yeah. I know of this technology. I've followed their press releases very carefully. They say that their car runs on salt water, and it's way more powerful horsepower-wise than a Porsche and a Ferrari. It's not on the shelves. You cannot buy this car.
Yep. And again, I go back to what we talked about at the very beginning of the show, that the consciousness of this planet is got blinders on, and that's through the money. And money is controlled by banks. And that is a very pyramidal structure. We even have that on our dollar. So if your invention upsets that pyramidal order, you aren't getting a loan for investment.
Yeah. And then you can't get wind in the sails to start manufacturing of your product.
Yeah. We're seeing Tesla really battling for its existence for a frickin' electric car. And he was a billionaire who self-funded, but he's having one hell of a time with suppliers suddenly shutting down or having a fire. And it's not like it's just him. Ford has stopped making their F-150 trucks for a year because one of their suppliers had a fire. So that stuff does happen, but it also makes you very, very, very vulnerable to malevolent forces. If they don't want you in business, they'll right. put you out.
One more thing on this residual ghost scenario. You know, I was just in New Orleans. I was living in New Orleans. I was doing comedy out there. And it always seems to me, I don't want to, that there's a group of comics that would, like, write the fewest amount of jokes. They would, you know, use the same comics for all their show. They would have a book show. They would do the same performance every single time. And they would book the... you know, the same comics that were their friends all the time. And you would see that the evolution of their comedy would plateau. It would stagnate because they wouldn't feel comfortable getting people from outside their clique, you know. And it became these cliques of, oh, these comics will hang out together and do shows together. These comics are a different group. They hang out and do... And I was always going, you guys are fucking up. You guys got to... Like, you're saying that... This guy wouldn't do well at your show. No, that guy would be like the catfish at the bottom of the tank that nips at your fins and keeps you guys honest, keeps you guys writing. They would get in these cliques of people that wouldn't criticize them or wouldn't do a bunch of new material that would get the crowd programmed in a different way to make. I don't know. I just think that there's a. It's like abundance mentality means that you share, you all play together, and scarcity mentality is where these oil companies are, where there is a scarce amount of dollars every year, and we have to make sure that we get all of them. And so we have to have the same idea over and over again and protect the interests of the small oil mindset. You know, so this analogy plays out in so many different ways of just human psychology of, you know, people being afraid to change, afraid to try new stuff, you know, because the old stuff is working and they got a lock on that scam, you know. So,
yes.
I'm sure in the art community, is there any backstory?
I can see one of the things that fascinates me about the art community is, you know, particularly here in New York, I can go to some galleries and there is art just selling amazing money. And I look at it and I go, it's really not even thought-provoking art. You know, like, I'm not criticizing Andy Warhol, but a fucking tomato soup can is now iconography? What? I mean, it's the level of imagination it takes to repaint a soup can, and everybody freaking loves that, where you have some other artist that actually has something to me that's more compelling than a soup can picture is not really understood. So part of it is the level of audience, and also... What we value in this society isn't really an original idea, it's a popular idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, I live in New York and I have friends that will say, oh my gosh, look across the street, that's so-and-so celebrity. I'm clueless who they are. And I've even met celebrities and had a great time with them. Because you know what? They knew I didn't know who they were.
Right.
And so they enjoyed having a conversation that wasn't about their celebrityism. It was just a normal freaking conversation. And then another friend goes, Christopher, do you know who you were talking to? And I'm like, no, who?
Right. Like, you're, like, more on a soul-to-soul level, and they're, like, on a status math. Like, oh, that person is this famous, so I'll be friends with them this much, and then I'll have this canned conversation.
Yeah.
I always thought that Jackson Pollock was the biggest pile of shit ever. Like, personally, he, like, murdered two girls at the end of his life by drunk driving. His art was all terrible. He was the first guy to think of splattering paint all over. And it's like... I get Picasso, though. He was trying to, he was, you know, doing stuff. But I don't know, Jackson Pollock, it's like anyone can shit on a canvas, but only because it says Jackson Pollock on the corner is it worth $1.8 million. So it's not the art, it's the person whose name recognition is worth
and,
something.
And why the hell are baseball cards of any value? I don't get that. I do not get it. Because they're mass printed. But people, there are people that believe it. So there you have it.
That's funny you say that because it's like Michael Jordan is represented in a baseball card, like his rookie card from 1985, and his basketball accomplishments make that print worth something at that time. That's interesting. And then it goes up and down in value based on how they're playing. Yeah.
Yeah.
These cards, these pieces of cardboard.
Yes.
It's the ultimate, like, status math, like, you know, just name recognition.
One of the things I can say is I have been told that one of the best ways that extraterrestrials telepathically describe money is they call it magic paper with photos. And what the hell... when you put it in that concept, why do we put such value on magic paper with photos? Because that's what it is.
They're falling from the sky in every rap video.
Yeah.
So you knew a guy who knew an extraterrestrial? Where are you getting this information?
I don't want to get into the real details of how I know things because... it is really complex, but let me just tell you that consciousness has a way of letting people know information that they are ready to receive and incorporate. And we talk about meditation. I have had meditative moments where thoughts have entered into my head that did not come from my consciousness. And it's not hearing voices, it's not some kind of pathology like that. But prayer is listening, in my opinion. And if you listen to the universe, any number of beings are capable of contacting you. And that's what I mean. So it's not like some being walked off a ship and took me on a ride through space. I'm not talking about that. But when I say extraterrestrial, what I mean is it is outside of my terrestrial head information that comes in. If you want to call it imagination, you can call it imagination. I'm not offended by that. So how did I come up with the concept of magic paper with photos? I believe it is a telepathic understanding that I had.
So you think that your brain is more of an antenna than its own motor?
Oh, absolutely. I experiences where I have had objects literally appear beside me that gave me indication that what I was going to do the very next day was being celebrated. I literally was sitting in a park on a bench and a purple umbrella appeared right next to me. And that had meaning for the activity I was doing the next day. I'm not kidding you.
You were doing an art installation where a purple umbrella was apropos to the situation, and then one falls right next to you.
One, literally, I sit down at the park, and I look over, and there is a purple umbrella, and it wasn't there when I approached the bench.
So, I guess we've been way over an hour and a half now. I think we should just say, like, You know, look out for moments of synchronicity in your life that have meaning. If you're paying attention, if you're really aware, if you're free of pain, smoke a little weed, get a massage, open your antenna way up, and
and however you want to conceptualize that coming into your life through standard concepts or supernatural, we all see the world differently. And being open to that is the magic of life. Like you don't have to do anything in the world to be happy, but to separate from everything else takes tremendous concentration.
Well, thanks, Christopher Poppert. You're my best read guest, my most well-read guest. You know, one of the most eloquent. We have, like, very similar political beliefs. It's fun to talk to you. So thanks for doing my podcast for the second time. And I'm moving to New York City in October, and I will see you in person then, sir.
That is wonderful. I look forward to that. Take care.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. Bye now. I'll post this probably Tuesday.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, buddy. Take care now. Thank you to my guest, Christopher Poppert. Check out his Facebook feed, man. It's filled with information. Everything from political scandals to what's going on with Mike Pence, trying to figure out what's going on with chemtrails. Anyway, Christopher Poppert's Facebook feed is filled with information. He posted lots of great articles. He is a great guest. He's a really smart guy. He just burped there. Anyway, I'm eating lunch now. It's late Sunday night. I have a roast battle May 22nd, Tuesday, in the belly room of the Comedy Store. I'm going up against Brian McDaniel. Now, if you would please show up. This is an important battle. I've been working out. I've been getting massages. I've been doing a lot of spiritual work. I've been looking into Brian's life, his past. His wife is Mexican. He used to work for TMZ. You know, there's a lot of things going on in my head. I'm meditating on it. I have a, I don't want to get graphic. I just, can I share with you my artistic process? I wanted to dominate Brian McDaniel. So I made a lot of headshots, 12 headshots. I put him in a satanic circle. I put candles out, and I masturbated furiously onto the headshots, each and every one, 12 times. I recited rituals from dead languages. Ghosts were, I talked to some djinn spirits. So I talked to like maybe 64 of the 72 ghosts of the Akashic Records. They're on my side. So I've been doing a lot of prep work for this roast battle against Brian McDaniel. That will be happening May 22nd in the Comedy Store. And watch me ritualistically sacrifice the ego of a overrated local road hack called Brian McDaniel. The other thing I wanted to say is, well, I found a piece of audio. You know, every now and then someone emails me a piece of audio I didn't have before. If you don't remember, I used to play a character called Damien Shadows PI, and I would investigate different paranormal things happening and paranormal events. I played a character, Damien Shadows PI. So check out Theater of the Deranged 2. You can get that on Amazon. I play Damien Shadows. But also, if you just go to YouTube, there's a whole web series going on of Damien Shadows PI. And I mention that because when I first went to Shriekfest, premiering the pilot of Damien Shadows PI, the pilot comedy series episode that was 16 minutes long, available right now on YouTube, I went to Shriek Fest. There was a lot of mixers, and I had this interview. This is me in 2012. I just created my first TV show pilot. I was at a film festival. I was delusional. I thought I was going to be famous. This is my interview from 2012.
Our next guest, Eric Hollerbach of Damien Shadow's PI.
Well done, he said it right. I thought I was going to get a holler back for sure. Hollerback! There we go.
Yeah, we're having Sean write out everything a little bit clearer this year.
Sean's got good handwriting.
And now this is a short film, but also you said, interestingly, would it be fair to call it maybe a backdoor sitcom pilot?
I would say that's very fair. I don't know where the backdoor is coming from. I don't know what you're into, sir, but... Yeah, it's a
sci-fi channel term.
Okay. All right. Well, I hope you're gentle.
Well, I'm sure our audience knows the intricacies of the sci-fi channel's development speak.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so, this is business talk. You gotta go in the back door in order to get
this. Is a multi-platform launch?
Yeah, it is a multi-platform launch. We gotta get our synergy up to the vertical integration.
Of course. It all sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Tell us about the movie.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So it's I play Damien Shadows. I'm a psychic ghost hunter. You know, it's kind of like a ghost hunting parody, but we were really careful not to make it like Ghost Hunters or make it like it's its own thing. It's like character driven, you know. So I'm this. By day, I work in an arcade, and by night, I ghost hunt, and I have, I'm, internet famous, you know, and so I'm all delusional about my internet famous stuff. I have a very small audience, though.
No, we understand about delusional fame.
And to be in this business,
we understand internet famous and delusion, yeah.
Yes, we are. That's what our whole life is.
We understand that vertical integration.
Vertical delusion?
Vertical delusion, yeah.
And multi-platform delusional
fame? Multi-platform chain of vertical delusions.
And you get right in the back door.
Yes.
Yes.
You always have to make a back door so hackers can get in and bomb you.
Yes, exactly. We're backdoor delusional.
So this your first festival?
No, I had one thing way back in college that I won't say its name. Please don't look it up.
What's it called?
It's called Intimate Frostbite. There's no way anyone can find
it.
It's on a VHS tape buried 6 feet under the ground.
Essentially in snow. Buried in snow.
Yeah, exactly.
Intimate Frostbite.
Yeah. It's the stupidest movie ever. And then I had this thing called Pets of the Rich and Famous in the Beverly Hills TV New Media Festival. And now this is my third festival.
Oh, very cool.
Sweet.
I held the microphone low, and then he just starts, picking up the microphone. Yeah. I thought he was like, what, you want me to suck your dick?
Yeah, no, suck it.
Started shaking it. Yeah. I'm like, dude, I already had the back door talk.
Just give me a handy, and then we'll...
This is a horror festival.
This is degenerated. I'm sorry, I brought the class level way down of your podcast.
This is a horrible festival. Yes.
We got to start talking more about unicorns again.
I know. Let's get back on track. So where are you at with the film? Are you just taking it to festivals or?
What I'm doing is I'm doing this pilot, and also we're making the actual web series that Damien Shadows himself has made. So what you're going to see at the festival is a documentary about Damien Shadows making his web series, and then we're also making the actual web series. So
that's
awesome. Going to be done in December. It's still in post right now, so we're hitting Shriek Fest October 6th, Saturday at 2 p.m. in Rayleigh Studios. Shriekfest.com, man.
Let's do it.
Cool. Well, pleasure meeting you, Eric.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Hey, thanks a lot.
Good luck,
Eric.
For the film.
Right. Good luck, brother.
Thank you.